supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Mahatma Gandhi once said, "We must be the change we wish to see in the world." Well, today, as we celebrate Gandhi's birthday, it seems difficult to be optimistic about change. In Burma, bullets were fired into a crowd of peaceful protesters last week, killing at least 10 people. Some sources say many more protesters have been killed. And Burma is just one place in the world. Their peace seems to be far out of reach. And we don't even have to look around very far. In our own city of Philadelphia, the murder rate has reached an all-time high, and violence seems ever-present. So, keeping in mind Gandhi's words, is peace attainable? Some think it is. And that maybe it all starts from the brain, or the heart, or the mind. My guests today are Dr. Patrick Swift and Daniel Hunter. Swift is a clinical neuropsychologist at NYU Medical Center, and he has written One Mountain, Many Paths. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. So much to be here. So glad to be here.
Daniel Hunter is here in the studio with me. He's with Training for Change here in Philadelphia. He's a Philadelphia street organizer creating social movements in the city of Philadelphia. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
And to you, our audience, our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about creating peace. That's 888-477-9499. Daniel, let me start with you. What's happening in Burma has me deeply concerned, like so many others. It's not unlike the massacres we heard about in Africa. The world watches, people express outrage, and nothing really seems to happen. I wonder why advocates for violence seem to be so powerful as opposed to advocates for peace.
Well, I think that one of the things is that violence certainly is more visible. And when we talk about peacemaking, it often happens at the grassroots. It happens at local levels. So, for example, in Burma right now, we hear about the 10 people who were killed, and certainly I think there's a lot more than that, who were involved in street protests and led by monks organizing and doing street marches against the Burmese dictatorship. And what's less visible are the local grassroots efforts, that is, the efforts of peacemaking that show up as people resist the military dictatorship in sometimes small but sometimes successful ways. And those are the ingredients for peace, which is peace isn't something that we simply see dramatically every day. It's often the small things, the small relationships, the organizing work that's happened to be able to get people to be less fearful of the military dictatorship.
Patrick, I'd like to hear your take on this. Why violence seems to attract so much attention and influence, and peacemaking just does not.
It is it's a troublesome question. Why does peace get the short end of the stick when it comes to attention? And I think it's an adaptive one. We have to pay attention to people that behave violently. It's the easiest response and the most damaging on a personal level and on a global level.
Well, as a neuropsychologist, I would imagine we are hardwired to respond quickly and aggressively to violence or threats of violence.
Absolutely. There is a hardwiring in terms of our responses to identifying threat, etc. If you just look at the neurophysiology of the brain in terms of the primitive aspects of the brain up through to the frontal lobes, we have all kinds of choices in front of us. The question is, how do we respond to the stimuli in our lives? How do we respond to what's going on in the world? And as a neuropsychologist, I'm interested in how neurology informs the peace process, how psychology informs the peace process, and what is the direction that we can go. And honestly, when you look at what's going on in Burma, there are people as we speak, who are putting their hearts and their minds together to think about ways to work for peace in their communities. And that mental process is what fascinates and inspires me.
You quoted a lot of peacemakers, peace advocates in your book. What would Gandhi say about Burma if he was alive today? What would he do?
tough one to say. I know that one of my favorite quotes from him is that religions are different roads converging upon the same point. What does it matter that we take different roads so long as we reach the same goal? And that wisdom in the religious leadership, the moral leadership of the moral authorities in Burma, are kindred spirits to leaders and people of faith from all around the world, that these might be people of different religious tradition than perhaps one of your listeners, but there's a shared humanity and a shared spiritual wisdom that brings us together that can inspire us to work for peace. And I think that's, I'm certain that that's part of what, that's what part of Gandhi's message meant to me.
Daniel, what's your take? What would Gandhi do witnessing Burma, witnessing the slaughters in Africa? What would he do?
Well, I think Gandhi said that the kind of violence that we see is political violence. That is, it's violence that's instituted by government. And he would say that the responsibility lies both with the government in terms of their actions, but also with the people, so far as they're still willing to cooperate with the government. He said that no government can exist without the support of its people. That is to say, a government can't function, a dictatorship even as well, can't function without some level of cooperation by local people going along with it. A lot of that's out of fear of violence and retribution, but that a government on its own can't engage in all of the functions that a government has to do. It can't build roads, it can't build bridges, it can't milk cows, it can't distribute food, it can't police roads without the support of the police, the farmers, the all the workers. So what Gandhi says is, he says, if you're wanting to resist and wanting to change a political structure, then you change it by not cooperating, by what he called non-cooperation. And you non-cooperate with an unjust system, in this case the Burmese government. So I think what he would say is, he would say the people, one, go out and march in the streets, but also build yourself an alternative institutions. Build institutions that don't require the government to have its hand in what you're doing, such that you can create an alternative institution outside of the government itself. Because Gandhi said, if you're trying to build a peaceful government, you need to have a democratic government. You need to have a government that responds to the will of the people.
Well, Gandhi said that it's always political. I look at Burma, I look at some other trouble spots, and a lot of it is economic. Now, I know the two get blurred, but, you know, I see in Burma a lot of the non-action is because of economic, because of oil interests. And I would think passivity and passive resistance, and I'll turn to you, Patrick. Passive resistance is very quiet compared to economic interests. That's a tough battle to fight.
It requires it requires behavioral change. It requires getting uncomfortable and looking at what's going on and making a choice to do something about it, whether it's on a personal level. From that social environment in Burma, there are thousands and thousands of people who are essentially fed up, saying no more. And with that collective sense of awareness, there is a plea and work for change. But on a, and I think it's an excellent point in terms of globally, as we sit and watch Darfur, 10 African Union military shot by militants there. As we sit and watch, we have choices. All of us have choices in how we respond. Whether you're in Philadelphia or whether you're in Paris, we're all, if ultimately there is a personal choice to recognize that we are members of a human family, And to use the analogy of the brain, to use the analogy of recognizing there are billions of neurons in the brain, and if a neuron wants to discount itself and think, I don't count, well, the fact is we need all of us. And there is a collective sense of the brain in the same way there is a collective sense of family.
Well, that's where I want to go. I want to switch gears, and I'll turn to you, Daniel. You know, Patrick said, we all have a choice. Well, we do, except I'm sitting in my living room, which is very comfortable, and I see this turmoil out there, and I don't see any impact it has on me. Our nation is fighting a war. I'm not feeling it. And if I am socially minded and feel somewhat involved, I might write a check, and then I'm done. Then I'll feel good for the moment. You talked, Daniel, about the connection between conflict in families and world conflict. I want to make this more personal. Could we go even further and talk about conflict within ourselves? How many people do we all know, including ourselves, when we judge ourselves harshly and often use aggressive and violent language, what we call ourselves names?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've done, for example, multiple trainings in Burma on the inside, working with democracy activists. And one of the things that they faced again and again was fear. That is, people being scared of military repression, people being scared of bullets, people being scared sometimes of just sort of economic reprisal by the government. And I think there's a similar theme here in the U.S., which is also an issue of fear, which is, for example, I've been working doing organizing in Casino Free Philadelphia, which has been fighting against two mega-sized slot parlors here in Philadelphia being placed in residential neighborhoods. And in here in Philadelphia, we also face a level of fear. That is, fear. People are scared to speak out around what they know to be a corrupt process and a corrupt deal because they're scared of potentially retribution from some of the faction leaders in the city. They're scared of their job. They're scared to be able to fully say what's on their mind. And I think some of what we struggle against in terms of building a peaceful and nonviolent world is one in which people are less and less scared to do what they know to be right.
Well, how do we do that? And that gets back to you, Patrick. I mean, this is the business of fear. And I think, you know, what Daniel's suggesting is often people don't do the right thing because of fear. And I have a feeling often people do the wrong thing because of fear. So how do we combat that institutionally? I mean, I know how to deal with it in my office, one-on-one or in group therapy, but, you know, how do you look at a community or a nation and deal with that level of anxiety?
I think that's an exciting question. I think that is the question. How is it possible? I mean, when you ask the question, is peace possible? How do we go about building peace within globally and addressing this business of fear? And the United Nations UNESCO Charter has a wonderful statement in its charter that says, since war begins in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed. And I have this image of construction equipment and scaffolding going up and building peace, and there are these jerks who are tearing down the scaffolding, and we continue to build and build and build. How do we go about building peace and community? And I believe part of it is, of course, heart. But part of it is, of course, there's a mental process that goes in recognizing what we share in common.
Let me turn back to you, Daniel. What did you tell the people in Burma about building peace? They certainly have every reason to be fearful.
Absolutely. What I said to them, and found this to be really useful, was do one thing that's fearful. As a community, which is one of the ways to combat fear, is to do it collectively. So in Burma, for example, when people were really scared of the government cutting down a whole forest, people did something which in this context, in the U.S., would be not scary at all, but in the Burmese context was terrifying, which is they put up posters that told the government, don't do it, or we'll rise up in protest. And in this case, this was in northern Burma, in this case, the action actually was successful. It was enough of a deterrent that the government relented and didn't cut down the forest. It's actually still there.
It's interesting. When you say band together as a community and do something you're afraid of, that's straight down the middle psychotherapy for anxiety disorders, for phobias, for OCD, and for life. You know, don't honor your fear.
Exactly. And I'd love to give an example from Philadelphia, for example, which is one of the things that in Philadelphia we've seen is a lot of meetings that are held in private or public organizations like the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board, which is overseeing the gambling industry in Pennsylvania, lock out the public. For example, in their so-called public hearings, the public isn't allowed to speak. So for 17 months, it's been going like this, where no one's allowed to speak. And so we gathered a group of people the last meeting of the Pennsylvania Game Control Board here in Philadelphia when they came. And about a dozen of us went to the Game Control Board and attempted to speak. So we attempted to testify, and myself, I was pulled out by the police, and there were several other people who were also pulled out. But we were practicing what Gandhi would see as practicing the world in which we want to see, which is we wanted to see a open, transparent process where the public's allowed to give input and testimony. So that's the kind of action that I think Gandhi would be very supportive of, because he says what you need to do is you need to practice a culture of resisting fear. And you do that collectively, you do that with other people, which is the concept of organizing. And you do it in a way in which it allows people to envision and practice the world that they're seeking. In our case, we wanted an open, transparent meeting, so we went ahead and testified. And in this case, the Game Control Board didn't allow us to speak and actually closed down the entire meeting rather than allow the public to speak. But tomorrow we'll be going down to Scranton and trying it again. And we hope that we'll have more success at being able to testify than we did last time. But it's the persistent attempt at building the world that we want to do, even if it's a little bit fearful for us.
I want to ask a personal question of you, Patrick, before we go to break. You come to the business of peacemaking from an interesting perspective, but most of us who devote our lives to making peace at whatever level, our work usually begins early in childhood. So when did you first start thinking about peacemaking?
Well, I come from a multicultural and multi-faith family with a Spanish-speaking Mexican mother and Texan father, and the crossroads of culture, and I eventually went into the Jesuits for a while and left. So crossroads of culture and spirituality, religion, have always appealed to me, and then eventually neurology and psychology. But it really wasn't until the planes flew into the World Trade Towers here that my wife worked in one tower and my mother-in-law worked in the other that it really became a very personal response. Fortunately for my family, one that we were okay with, but it really brought it home that this is important for all of us.
We've got to take a short break. I appreciate your answer. When we come back, we'll speak with Scott Appleby, who's a professor of history at Notre Dame, but he serves as the John Reagan Director of the Joan Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. He's got a very interesting take on this. We're talking about peacemaking. How to do it? Can it be done? Is it realistic? My guests are Patrick Swift, a clinical neuropsychologist at NYU Medical Center, and has written One Mountain, Many Paths. I'm also joined by Daniel Hunter, who is with Training for Change here in Philadelphia. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital joins you in supporting WHYY. For cancer treatment, Jeff is an NCI-designated cancer care facility. Jeff Cancer Care combines teams of physicians, PET and IMRT technology, and research access with personal support. Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, advanced medicine, superior care. Known by their first name, Jeff. Information online at jeffersonhospital.org or by phone 1-800-JEFF-NOW.
On the next Fresh Air, director Wes Anderson and actor Jason Schwartzman. Their new film, The Darjeeling Limited, is about three brothers on a spiritual quest to India. Schwartzman first worked with Anderson on the film Rushmore. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about peacemaking on the eve of Gandhi's birthday and surrounded with so much violence in the world and in our own home here in Philadelphia. My guests are Daniel Hunter, who's with Training for Change here in Philadelphia. I'm also joined on the phone by Dr. Patrick Swift, who's a neuropsychologist at NYU Medical Center, and he's written One Mountain, Many Paths. But joining me now on the phone is Scott Appleby. He's a professor of history at the University of Notre Dame, and he is director of the Joan Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. Scott, welcome to the show. We don't have Scott just now. We've got technical problems, which is one of the many joys of live radio. Patrick, The genesis of your book you mentioned right before the break begins with 9/11. You literally witnessed the towers crumbling. I believe you said when you were sitting on a bed, one of your patients' bed. What impact did that have on you personally?
It was a physical response. I felt it in my gut as each floor fell of the tower, and I literally felt like someone was kicking me in my gut as each tower fell, kind of visceral response. As I became aware it was happening because of the patient I was speaking with, his face became torn with agony, and he began crying. He began crying, saying, "No, no, not again." And I turned to look, and this is happening. And from that day, I looked at my practice differently. From that day, I looked at my world differently.
How so?
Well, as a neuropsychologist, on a daily basis, I'm asking people after a brain injury, getting a sense of their abstract reasoning skills. Some people, after they have a brain injury, can have diminished memory, concentration, language, abstract reasoning skills. Many of our vets coming back from the conflict in Iraq. And the experience of asking a patient how are a banana and an orange similar, which is a useful question and a series of questions to get a sense of their ability to see the larger amid the smaller differences. If I asked you, how are those two similar, you're probably going to tell me they're fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Philly, this is Philly radio, so if I ask someone who's a how the Phillies and the Mets are similar.
They're not.
Good answer. However, I must point out, sir, that the abstract ability to recognize that those are, obviously, you know the answer I'm going to tell you, which is they're baseball teams within the same league. And there are people who get so caught up in those differences that they're willing to kill each other. But for most of us on this planet, we can affectionately have rivalry, but recognize that it's baseball, we love our teams, but we're essentially in this together because if there weren't the other team, there wouldn't be sportsmanship, and really the values come behind it.
I want to challenge you on that. My observations over the last decade, when you say most of us are willing to see the similarities and not the difference. My experience over the last decade, maybe longer, is people are more insecure, more isolated. We did a show a few years ago on gated communities, and at the time it was the most rapidly growing form of housing. And people in gated communities spent more money per capita on security systems. We read about, you know the research about Bowling for Columbine. We've got less friends.
Yes.
I And red states are crimson red, blue states are navy blue. I think we are more afraid of one another. And there's, you know, the competition between religions, it's almost like lunchroom at camp, you know? Whose table is better than the other table?
I follow what you're saying. I mean, the business of fear, home security agents, outfits are making hand over fist, I'm sure. But I have to point out that there is the perception that it's the lunchroom battle, I'm better than you. And that's the amazing thing. When you look at the Gallup data, in fact, there's a Gallup poll data from the most recent is a 2005 study, but there was a study done a few years back in which the author was explicitly stating the perception socially is that there is this madness at the throat. But the truth is, when you poll Americans, there is a great deal of religious tolerance. In general, Americans are religious and spiritually tolerant people, despite what is portrayed in the media. If you look at Gallup poll data, 95% believe in God. A vast majority tolerant of different points of religious spiritual view, that's 82%. And almost half of Americans view other religions as legitimate paths on the spiritual journey.
Well, what you have just said is a perfect segue then back to Scott Appleby, who we now have on the phone. So I appreciate that perfect segue.
Good.
So Scott Appleby, as I said, is with us now. He's a professor of history at Notre Dame. He's director of the Joan Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell us what you do at the Institute for Peace.
We specialize in strategic peace building, is the term we use, which means that we have professors and alumni and students who work first and foremost in different conflict settings around the world. But as they do that, they take an approach to those conflict settings which we'd call holistic. That is, they're looking at everything from disputes over water rights to religious and ethnic composition to the political situation, political parties, to arms trade and so forth in those communities, and asking where are the places, who are the players in the communities, and where are the places where we can build constructive relationships for the reduction of violence and the bridging of gaps between special interest and people.
Who's the we? Who are you working with, and where are they going? Or
well, the other part of the we is the strategic part, is that we're working in these communities. Our graduates are, our students are, and some of our faculty with peace builders in those communities, or local officials and educators and others who are open to this kind of dialogue. But the strategic part of that peace building process is we try to educate our students to be in interaction on the vertical level, that is, with government officials, non-governmental organizations, the World Bank, various agencies that provide resources in these communities for resolving conflict.
I want to read a quote from an article you wrote on September 28th, 2001, just a couple of weeks after 9/11. You said, after September 11, signs of hope appeared in the denunciation of extremist violence by Muslim leaders. Denouncing violence perpetrated by co-religionists is a courageous act that must be repeated in the months and years ahead. But it must be complemented by efforts to develop active peace building within Islam and other religious traditions. It's been 6 years, Scott. What's your... Has it happened?
It's happening. I wouldn't say it's definitively happened so that we can point to success. But one of the challenges of peace building, I think your other guests will agree, is that if we use the kind of time frame that our government and that policymakers often use, which used to be 6 years, now is 6 months or 6 weeks, then we fail automatically. Building peace is going to take time, and it doesn't mean that it's an open-ended question with no metrics or no ways of measuring success, but it means that peace building is ultimately relationship building. So you do do see since 9/11 all kinds of initiatives and in every level of society. I just read a minute ago a new email that the Luce Foundation has supported various programs, the latest one at Harvard, on integrating the study of religion into our international affairs education at the highest level, at higher ed. That may seem to have very little relevance to interreligious dialogue, but in fact, if we don't have more sophistication about religion, its integrity, its independence from other sectors, we don't begin. There have been initiatives within not only the increasing tendency of co-religionists to speak out against violence. That has, in fact, accelerated in the years since 9/11. There have been NGOs founded and other kinds of partnerships within Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. 9/11, in some ways, was the best thing that could have happened to this kind of intra- and interreligious collaboration.
Why don't we hear about it?
Well, I don't want to blame folks, but I'll start with the media. You know, what sells papers and gets people to pay attention in an increasingly saturated market is that there are not enough shows like yours, or that is to say, shows in which there's thoughtful discussion of the pros and the cons. So obviously what leads the field in the discussion of Myanmar, Burma, is the violence that has occurred and the confrontation. What you don't hear about, because it's not quite as sexy or exciting, is the fact that those monks didn't come out of nowhere and that movement didn't spring up overnight. This is a Gandhian style, in many respects, movement that has been building through covert, below the radar, relationship building in different segments of Burmese society, and by the way, some outsiders, including some of the people that we know about in our own worlds here in the U.S., who've been fostering that kind of nonviolent movement for social change and political change, and it's just not known because it not only is it not dramatic enough to make the headlines, but it's in its very nature invisible, discreet relationship building. You call attention to some of these relationships before they blossom, come to fruition, and you kill them. So there are a number of factors that keep it below the radar. That doesn't mean it always has to be, in every respect, unknown to people.
You know, when you talk about what happened in Burma, it gets us to one of, you quoted Pope Paul VI's well-known exhortation, if you want peace, work for justice. But justice is defined very differently by everyone. The people with guns in their hands are fighting for justice, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. To assume a kind of universalist human rights or sense of justice without the appropriate cultural nuance is a dead end. On the other hand, we have come a long way since 48 in identifying certain elements that would be the conditions for a sustainable, what we call here, just peace, that is, a peace with justice. And they're somewhat obvious, I would think, to people. That is, access to education for women and children as well as males, a clean drinking water, processes to resolve conflict without immediate resort to violence. You can go on and on down the list. These are conditions within which authentic human flourishing can occur, which human rights are respected, and they're not mysteries. We can get into deep philosophical discussions about this or that particular ethical decision, but there's so much common ground and there's so much progress that can be made on the non-neuralgic issues that it's a pity that more people aren't part of the discussion, as your other guests have mentioned.
Well, speaking of that, we're going to have to take a break in a couple minutes, but before we do, I want to hear from all three of my guests, and we'll start with you, Patrick Swift, as a neuropsychologist. Why do so many people not work for justice?
Well, I've got to begin by just pointing out to Scott's previous point that the New York Times, September 25th, had an article. It got buried in the paper, but an article in which the Prime Minister of Iraq, Muslims from Iraq, Iran, India, broke fast during Ramadan here in Queens. And that's a tremendous in terms of people coming together from different perspectives with shared interests. Of course, it did make the front page, but it's there. It just doesn't get as much attention. And I think that gets to the question you just asked me, is why don't we get more involved? And that relates to many people are familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We have these basic needs, and fires get great attention on the media. If there's a fire, they're going to have a camera there right away. It keeps people glued to the TV. If people are getting their basic needs met is one thing, but there is what I perceive is also a manipulation of people's fears for people to behave in certain ways, so that people stay afraid if they focus on what's being put in front of them. What makes the front page? That peace hasn't been attained in the past. I love Scott's point about time frames. If this mess that humanity's gotten itself into over essentially millennia, God help us. I hope this doesn't take several more millennia to get through. But I think in this age of internet speed, etc., it is possible for there to be rapid gains over time. But this has to be taken a look at from a larger scale. And I do see and believe people are getting more interested and more involved in finding what joins us together. How can we make a difference? Where are we going? How are we going to get out of this?
Daniel Hunter, what's your take? Are more people getting involved, or are more not?
I think that we're seeing most definitely a rise in violence in many respects. We're seeing weapons that can destroy at higher rates and larger rates and more civilian casualties. At the same time, we're also seeing more nonviolent social movements. That is, we're seeing the expansion of Gandhi's initial experiments in nonviolence and nonviolent struggle. And I think rather than framing the story of Burma right now as a story of one of sadness and fear, I think it's actually a story of hope and exploration of nonviolent struggle, which is the people in Burma are experimenting in what now millions of people around the world have experimented in, which is overthrowing dictatorships through nonviolent struggle. And that's been successful in Yugoslavia, where they overthrew Milosevic. That's been successful in the country of Georgia. It's been successful in the Philippines. It's been successful in numerous places around the world. And I think that's not getting reported. I think that's right. And I think we're actively being taught a particular framework, a particular slant, which is reporting not only news of violence, but also news of violence in a way that doesn't emphasize the fact that it's a nonviolent movement. That is, in Burma, I think we should be reporting the amazing courage of the monks, and also the amazing sophistication of organizing under intense amounts of repression. And rather than framing it simply as a story of violence, I think it's actually a story of nonviolent struggle, of organizing, and of some very sophisticated movement building.
Huh. We've got to take a short break. Scott Appleby, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Scott Appleby is a professor of history at the University of Notre Dame, and he's director of the Joan Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies. We are talking about peacemaking, what's involved in doing it, dealing with the fear that stops us often. We'll come back after a short break. We'll take your many calls that you've been waiting patiently. My guests are Dr. Patrick Swift, a neuropsychologist at NYU, who's written One Mountain, Many Paths. I'm also joined by Daniel Hunter, who's with Training for Change here in Philadelphia. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's here at WHYY 91 FM.
Mind Body Spirit Expo supports WHYY with Deepak Chopra, Marianne Williamson, and Brian Weiss at Valley Forge Convention Center, October 26th to 28th. Details at mindbodyspiritexpo.com.
Next time on Day to Day, soldiers get trained for war, but not for returning home.
Have someone say to you, hey, did you do the bills?
No.
Why not?
Well, because it's really not that important to me right now.
Well, our credit's important.
Yeah, I guess.
Now states are adopting a program that helps soldiers make the transition.
Unfortunately, there's no war peace switch. It takes time.
A plan for keeping peace at home, next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, 10,000 Villages and Media, hosting an Oriental Rug event October 10th through 14th, offering fairly traded hand-knotted rugs. Details at 610-892-5020.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are honoring Gandhi's birthday by talking about peacemaking today with Daniel Hunter, who's with Training for Change here in Philadelphia. I'm also joined by Dr. Patrick Swift, who's a neuropsychologist at NYU, and he's written One Mountain, Many Paths. As promised, we've got lots of people who've been waiting to join the conversation. We'll start with Tina. Tina, hi, you're on the air. Tina?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Dan, what a wonderful, wonderful way to give credence and respect to Mohandas Gandhi.
Thank you.
Love your show. I believe, I'm a peace activist, although not very active in it right now for personal reasons, but the light went on for me during the first Gulf War. And I worked very hard on a lot of different issues in the next few years after that. I believe the answer is that you can have peace, but conflict resolution, the premise of it, is humility. And I believe that if we had every classroom every day teaching conflict resolution, in about 15 or 20 years, we could have peace.
Well, I think that's an interesting take. I want to hear what my guests have to say. I'm going to start with you, Daniel.
Well, I'm certainly a fan of conflict resolution. It's actually how I started my organizing work, was first as a conflict resolution mediator working in the school system. And since then, I've also grown to appreciate the ways in which conflict resolution can be a useful tool in interpersonal relationships, but not necessarily that effective at some of the structural issues. That is, for example, when we talk about Burma, I think that there's more issues that we need to consider, and sort of some deeper structural problems of economic violence, of political violence. And my experience has been in training people around the world. I've led trainings for folks in Ghana and Sierra Leone and Indonesia, as well as in Burma, that there's also the technique of nonviolent struggle and of organizing, and that I think is about teaching people also the tools for organizing and for engaging in nonviolent social movements. And I really appreciate the direction that the caller's talking about, which is I think we do need a reorientation of our education system to teach people these techniques. There are techniques out there that are proving very successful in overthrowing dictators. Even in Iraq, years ago, we could have been supporting an emerging nonviolent social movement to overthrow Saddam Hussein years before we invaded. And we could be supporting those both within our own country and globally, rather than supporting the armed movements, which I believe are very responsible for increasing the levels of violence.
Tina, I want to thank you so much for your call. Conflict resolution, I think, well, you're right, we do need to teach peace in the classroom. We need to teach kids how not to fight, and we need to do it by not being so aggressive as adults. Patrick, you said that your book is about spiritual inspiration. There's an awful lot of spiritual information in bookstores, and frankly, some of it is pretty upsetting in its simplicity, you know, four steps to wholeness, or, you know, do this and then you can, you know, the universe will take care of it. What does it mean to you to be a spiritual person?
Well, there's I'm thinking of two aspects of that in the setup for your question, but me personally, to be a spiritual person is to recognize that we're on a journey in which we are growing, that we're not human beings having spiritual experiences, but spiritual beings having human experiences. And there is a personal growth and a spiritual growth that people can go through from childhood to adolescence to when you start to ask those tough questions of why am I here, what am I doing in my life, what is this world that I live in, on through looking at those larger questions, the sense of eternity and death and dying. Those answers change, and those answers have changed for me over time. But they have also become so much more relevant. And in the sense of humility, recognizing that I don't have all the answers. And my book starts with a short story of inspiration about peace, but it's actually quotes from all the great traditions, from Judaism to Christianity to Islam, and the messages that you find in the traditions about loving your neighbors yourself. So, in essence, the wisdom can be found by going to the writings that I don't need to claim to be the expert with these seven steps, and bang, you've got enlightenment or peace in the world. It ain't that easy, but we have to be on a journey.
Daniel, do you think one can be at peace and be with peace, work for peace, if they don't consider themselves spiritual beings?
Well, a lot of the activists I've worked with don't consider themselves spiritual beings, but I would consider them that. I don't think it's necessarily that someone has a spiritual path that they identify as, so much as that engaged in what Patrick called that journey. And I've seen that in a lot of activists, for example, who've turned away from religious orientation because of the ways in which religion gets used as a stick to beat people up, gets used as a weapon in many cases to oppress marginalized groups. And so for that reason, I see a lot of folks turning away from religions. But I think what Patrick's saying is right, which is there's a lot of wisdom there and a lot of wisdom for us to keep access to and to not turn our backs on. It's one reason, as a Baptist, for example, I'm proud of having a very strong tradition in the Baptist community of engaging in nonviolent movements. I'm very proud of the tradition of Dr. King and all the many folks who I get to carry on and the legacy. But I don't believe that one necessarily has to be explicitly spiritual in order to engage in a lot of these practices. In fact, some of the folks who I've most appreciated in my life have been activists and very dedicated workers who didn't identify as any religion or any spiritual path.
Dan, can I add one
thing
to that? In the sense of healthcare, I work literally in 5-10 minutes. I put a white coat on and I go back out to a brain injury unit where people have sustained strokes, brain tumors, aneurysms, and can't walk, talk, or think so well. And they're getting better here. But we work together as an interdisciplinary team. I'm a neuropsychologist with physicians, nurses, physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists. We all come from different traditions, different disciplines. And we work together with a common goal, and that's our patient's health. And that analogy, I believe, is an apt one when it comes to interfaith dialogue and peace building. Whether someone embraces a particular tradition or considers themselves a free agent when it comes to faith, when you walk in the doors here at the hospital, there are our service standards of caring, respect, integrity. And regardless of someone's race or religious perspective or whatever differences people might perceive, the person is treated with caring, respect, integrity, and that drives healthcare, ideally, in what we do, that I see on a day-to-day basis. And I've seen some real miracles when our patients make progress, because we work together as opposed to some particular discipline claiming to have a monopoly on the truth.
I want to make an observation and half answer my question. What do you talk about when you say work as a team, have a common goal, and the goal be the vision, all of us work together towards that goal? Well, terrorist groups are like that also. They have a goal, and they are working together at something they believe deeply. It made me think, when I had that reaction to your comments, Patrick, it made me think of a woman you worked with. I forget her syndrome, but she was blind and didn't know she was blind. And you used that as a metaphor. I'm going to ask if you can just briefly tell us that story.
Well, briefly what I'd say is I met a patient who had sustained several strokes, and because of the short version is multiple strokes throughout the brain that left her blind, but they also left her not knowing that she was blind, and it's called Anton syndrome, in which someone can be blind and not know it. And it's not just a psychiatric denial, oh, yes, I can, no, you can't, yes, I can. It's because of the neurology, the hardware being affected, as well as the sense of the lack of awareness in addition to the cortical blindness. And that is an apt analogy for some people who don't see the similarities that we share within the human family. And there are inspirational messages that these people manipulate to wreak havoc. If you take Margaret Mead's quote, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing it ever has." Those small folks, a small band of people, pulled together resources and brought down the World Trade Towers.
So
they made a difference. However, I do not perceive it as a positive one. But that kind of behavior inspires me to say, okay, you're going to pull that off. I am going to stand up. And the line in the sand is to say, what can I do? What can you do? What can one of your listeners do right now to say, no, that's not acceptable to me. I want this world to be in a better place.
I'm going to let you, Daniel, close the show by answering that question. What can I do? What can one of my listeners do right now?
Well, certainly I'd love to invite people to join the campaign of Casino Free Philadelphia. But I think the theme that's going on here is a theme about interconnection and interrelationship. And I think the theme is one in which we're saying that in order to build a better world, what you people need to be engaged with is a world in which there are more and more relationships holding people closer and closer together. And I think that starts in a lot of the different organizing of actions that are happening here in Philadelphia. There's an amazing array of social justice organizations, from Disabled in Action, Philadelphia Campaign for Housing Justice. All of these are groups that I invite people to participate in.
How? Where?
Well, there's been, for Casino Free Philadelphia, our website, www.casinofreephila.org, is one place where we invite people.
What if I want to work for world peace?
Well, I would say engage in some local issues that have some international significance. I believe that all of the campaigns that are inviting people to be more bold are, include that. Some of the local campaigns that I see doing that is Not in Our Name, and also some of the anti-war organizing.
Well, I want to thank you both, Patrick Swift and Daniel Hunter. I want to thank you both so much for joining us and for the work you do. I also want to remember at the end of the show, Betty Williams, who joined me several years ago, when I asked her the similar question, she looked at me and she said, if you want to do something, don't ask questions. Open your door, look at the world, and go do something. My guests have been Patrick Swift, author of One Mountain, Many Paths, and Daniel Hunter. He's with Training in Charge here in Philadelphia. Earlier we heard from Scott Appleby, who works with the Joan Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at Notre Dame. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can find me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Shane Ewing's our intern. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Take care.